When we were planning the service, I asked Rosemarie to, if she wanted to play some music, and she suggested some music from the popular music from the 40s because Mom enjoyed that and they liked to go dancing, and so we're going to do a few selections from the big band era. This is a small band version. Singing, whistling around the house.
Oh, Set the tone, I hope, for all of us today as we celebrate, affirm, and remember the life of Rachel Helen McCutcheon Siegfried. On behalf of Rachel's children, Maggie, Jean, John, and David, welcome to this service. We gather together this evening to bid one we have known and loved farewell and adieu. We gather to share the comfort from the music and song, words and thoughts, memories and meanings, joys and sadness that the loss of a loved one has inspired within us. We gather to say yes to life's greatest expression, love. Love believes all things, hopes for all things, endures all things. Love never ends. We shall celebrate Rachel Helen McCutcheon Siegfried's living, and we shall grieve Rachel Helen McCutcheon Siegfried's dying. Because we know the truth of William Blake's words, joy and woe are woven fine. Under every grief and pine runs a joy with silken twine. It is right, it should be so. We were made for joy and woe. Though we may have our own individual levels of grief, we should not be fearful of mourning. Rachel would not want us to let the shadow of death obscure the living Rachel, who touched so many times in so many ways, filling so many lives with memories, meaning, and love. Let us be wise enough and let us be brave enough this evening to honestly remember and bravely celebrate the life of Rachel Helen McCutcheon Siegfried. And in our gathering, we want to show our love and support for those who knew her best and loved her most, her children, Margaret, Jean, John, and David. It is good, right, and fitting that we have come together because a human life is sacred in its being born, in its living, and also in its dying. And so we would like to light our chalice this evening in memory of Rachel, in memory of her life. While the flame burns, for a short span or a longer span of time, it radiates light and heat. The passion of life are passed on. So even after the flame is extinguished or consumed, the fire of that life and love still burns. A cherished life lives on in the lives it has brought to life and all the lives that have been influenced and their caring, nurturing, and love. We have many words of expression this evening. Our choir is going to be presenting. We have musicians. We open with the music by our choir, Simple Gifts, and Paca Bell's Canon.
Is the gift to be free? Is the
Rachel Helen McCutcheon was born on January 10th, 1925, in Mangum, Oklahoma. The closest large towns to this small southwestern Oklahoma community are Elk City to the north and Altus to the south. Metropolises. Probably no more than 5,000. But in that rural area, Rachel grew up. Rachel was born the third child. Her identical twin older brothers and two younger brothers were on each side of her. Being the only girl, she had to do many of the chores around the house. That's because boys weren't expected to do housework or woman's work, as was the custom of that time. When she was a young girl in the 30s, that part of Oklahoma was in the center of what was called the Dust Bowl. The National Weather Service lists the Dust Bowl as the first of Oklahoma's top 10 weather events of the 20th century. The Dust Bowl of the 1930s also ranks among the most significant events of the century nationally by literally changing the face of the Great Plains. Extreme heat and drought, especially in 1934 and 1936. Rachel would have been around 12, 13, 14. The all-time record high temperature recorded in Oklahoma City in August 1936 was 113 degrees Fahrenheit. Who knows what it was further south and west in Mangum. Black Sunday was near the height of the Dust Bowl, with accounts of these giant clouds of dust descending on the panhandle town of Hooker, Oklahoma. Mangum is 100 miles to the south and east of Hooker. So they must have experienced those dust storms living in Mangum. Around 300,000 to 400,000 people were displaced during that time. Rachel, her brothers, and parents lived through these turbulent years. And I think we can all safely say that this had a lasting influence on her life and the way she lived her life. When she graduated from high school, she entered Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, majoring in chemistry. While at the university, she loved singing in choirs. Her love for music was something she cherished throughout her life. That was when she met Robert Siegfried. They fell in love, married in 1946. Bob was in the Navy and was being trained in Japanese and Asian language studies. They moved to Madison, where Bob finished his training here at UW. And this led to an academic career and brought the young couple to different teaching positions. While at Boston, they lived in Sharon, Massachusetts. Then in 1954, the family moved to Fayetteville, Arkansas, Bob taking a faculty position at the University of Arkansas. Then in 1958, to the University of Illinois at Urbana, and finally back here to Madison and the university in 1963. They lived in a little cottage on the edge of town with rather primitive accommodations. Primitive, to say the least, according to Maggie, was outdoor plumbing. That was on Badger Lane. In 1975, Bob and Rachel divorced. Rachel had to put her life together and began meeting the challenges of life as a single mom. There were low points at this time of her life. She contemplated the ending of her life. One night, she got into her car and drove west to the Mississippi River with suicide in her thoughts. Something drew her back from the edge, and she turned around and came back to Madison. She sought medical help and received inpatient care. Then Rachel began taking on many new phases of her life. Real estate sales, which didn't work out too well, but she also took up seamstressing, which did hold on to her attention and gave her a strength of professional employment. There was a feminist and activist phase, Wonder Woman phase, and these are all going to be elaborated on by those people who are listed in our service. There was a traveler phase. Whether she was dancing or gardening, arranging flowers or sewing clothes, she embodied spirit, and her ability to touch other lives was a deep expression of her being in step with the rhythms of life. She embodied the gift to live simply, with taste and classiness, to be grounded in values of honesty, integrity, and love. She came to embody the gift to be free, to know and accept yourself, to be free from striving for material things, to know what is most important in life. She embodied that gift to come down where you ought to be content with life, to delight in times with family and friends, to offer something good into the world every day. She embraced especially visits to northern Minnesota through her friends that she met in Urbana. She loved Keweenaw, the campground. And I have a personal connection because a few years before she wrote this poem on the back of our order of service, I was there at the same campground with friends who were mutual friends of the Lakers. Lost. Chuck Cowger were friends of the Lathrops, and they had a cottage, right, a few cottages from that family. And we were up there with our families, and we had canoe trips on the lake. And I can tell you, it is the most natural wilderness area I have ever been in. And I know why Rachel was so inspired by that place. These were the gifts she gave in the community where she volunteered her time generously. Social justice groups, civil rights, League of Women Voters, abortion rights groups. These were the gifts she gave to us here in Prairie, in our congregation, where she reached out to others and made deep and caring connections with friends. She served on the Denominational Affairs Committee, Social Action Committee, Housing and Property. In 1982, when her dear friend Betty Jollings was president, On Valentine's Day, Rachel and Dorothy Weatherby led a program that produced, you have to imagine this now, a 4 foot wide, 5 feet high cosmic Valentine that was wrapped and packaged and sent to the White House. In 1986, in October, Rachel did a special presentation based on the life of Eleanor Roosevelt, one of her heroines, called Me and Eleanor, based on that biography. She loved her grandchildren, and they loved her. For Rachel, life was for the living as fully as possible, which she did with grace and style and that classy elegance that you would recognize in the way she dressed, the way she kept her house, and the way she expressed herself. We shall miss her, but we are so much more grateful for her having lived. Rachel died peacefully at Oakwood, January 2nd. Bob is going to do a musical memory of Rachel. Careless Love. Thank you.
a tough act to follow. Mama, where are you? Are you in the pale lilac's rich scent of spring? Are you in the loamy earth warmed by the sun as I plant a seed for you? Are you in the sunbeam escaping the orange and purple twilight? Are you in the whispering cedars close by? Are you in the steaming cornbread, fresh green beans, and pork chops? Are you in my hands, helping me mend a seam or a scraped knee? I could never find you, you were so quiet. Now that you are gone, I'm still looking. You are everywhere. I can hear you.
You are revealing. Well, there really aren't too many words for it. She taught us to sing. She would sit down with us with the book? Anyway.
The Fireside Book of Folk Songs.
Probably a lot of you have that or seen it. And we'd go through it. We had our favorites, like Golden Vanity. Oh, let's sing the Golden Vanity. Oh, no, I'm so tired of it. But
it was so sad.
That's why I liked it.
She also used it as a tool to keep while we were on road trips.
Yeah.
Said, peace through music. Sing it. We're fighting over the seats in the back.
Oh, God.
I remember one of my earliest memories is going out in the snow from that little house on Badger, just off of Badger. And it was up to here on me and here on her.
Here on me.
Yeah. I think you were in the arm. So. But yeah, she had lots of things to teach us. And I remember that we'd take baths in the little wash tub.
I don't remember that. We had plumbing by the time I
came. Just in the tape.
I remember the time that our grandmother, that is my dad's mother, took a bath in that. But when Maggie was born, I don't remember it, but I heard the story.
She did.
So our grandma was taking a bath in one of those
washed,
and she couldn't get. Stuck in that watch. There she was, sitting there. She was taking a bath, naked, cold. Right. At least it was August.
Yeah. Well, I remember being my first moment of shame when she was telling somebody, maybe it was Grandma, about the exploit of when we climbed out the window and the.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was wonderful. My sister, I followed her everywhere.
Trip qualities.
We can tell these stories later.
Yeah.
We just practically gave her a heart attack. If she's sitting there in the dentist chair.
On the second floor.
And we go crawling by on the ledge.
My idea.
There was another sister.
But she took good care of us.
Same.
Was a referee and just you name it. She was a great mom. So, well, there's a couple of things she told me that was, cold, hard truths. Like, when I saw one morning, morning sun was shining on something over in the distance, and I was like, I just know that's a diamond. I was about 8 or something. So I went running out there to investigate and get my diamond, my fortune was made. And it was just an old can. And I came and I said, Mom, I just went over there and it was shining and I thought it was a diamond. She said, all that glitters is not gold. Right?
She never told me aphorisms like that. I wasn't running after them.
Yeah, right.
I'm wondering whether our brothers have any little stories to tell, if you have anything that you'd like to mention. I know times changed. You guys are younger than us, so we had this
not that much
cozy little family. I don't know what we've got back there, but there are pictures like,
the three of us.
Four of us. Dad and Mom and us.
Well, yeah. Mom and the girls,
Yeah. And one of my favorites is in Sharon, where I've got the cat inside my coat and it's looking out.
But what about when they tried to make you eat your peas?
Oh no, that's a story that's better for another time. But, you know, I'm just seeing that we're skipping right over. You know, when we were kids in Urbana, Mom was, even then, very active in politics. And she would go down and be a poll watcher. You know, that's when we were still kids. So, you know, her active political life started back then, because then she was actively the Democratic Party and the voters. Later on, she got a lot more radical. So you'll hear about that in a minute. Maybe that's a good segue.
Yes.
So is Pat here?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Pat Poses is going to talk a little about Mom's political career. She is one of Mom's cohorts in back in the day. And
I need something to lean on.
Okay, how about this?
You're right here.
Would you like to sit on a chair?
I would prefer to sit on a chair.
Okay.
Well, I'm not as young as I think I am.
What are we doing? Yeah. Are the stairs because we'll manage?
Yeah. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you. I'm going to make you too comfortable. I'll be here forever. Sue Eichhorn was giving me a hand, was there at the beginning of the Women's Political Caucus. I was where God meant you to be when the Women's Political Caucus was founded. Does it work?
Yes.
In Oshkosh, Wisconsin. So I was not here at the beginning. I came in 76, and I met your mother right away, and we started a 25-year program of going to Women's Political Caucus meetings, Democratic meetings, taking walks every afternoon and free concerts, but certainly more political campaigns than you can believe. And when I got here, Rachel was the treasurer of the Wisconsin Women's Political Caucus, an impossible job. There was a Platteville chapter that never thought of recording anything. They didn't think the government was interested that they had raised $35 an apron sale, or $20 in a cookie sale. There was also a Milwaukee caucus that didn't approve of any members. Not having members. No, they weren't good enough. Dade County had, Nancy Andrew had, when I wanted to get them, shoeboxes of papers. Endless shoeboxes. Linda and Back says your mother gave her the treasury. I always thought if I had to go to IRS, I would take the shoeboxes and say, does this apply to my taxes? You have never seen so many shoeboxes of I don't know what. But your mother throughout was a hero. She kept track of the members of the caucus and who paid and what paid for years. So we discovered the state had a record. Now, it's not that easy. Some people decided they had joined the caucus 3 years ago, and they didn't have to pay again. And if you remember, Lisa Blockstein kept meeting people at parties and saying, are you interested in the caucus? And whether they were or they were not, she put them on the membership list. And besides that, there were people who decided they would pay every 3 months. There were a couple of members who were always joining. They joined 3 months ago. It was good enough. They were going to join again. And throughout all this, Rachel kept the books till she gave them to Linda in the back of the room. She also worked on more campaigns and things, but I would like to tell, we used to take long walks almost every day, and Rachel's chief topic of conversation was how much the Women's Political Caucus meant to her as Sissy with three brothers. And she felt that it had changed her life. She felt she had to do all the chores and everything in Oklahoma, and she felt the great liberation and change in her life was the Women's Political Caucus. And she stood up taller and straighter because of the Women's Political Caucus. I now know about all her Mack brothers. Who's here said that they that one of the Mack brothers was hers?
And these are all children.
These are
all
her brothers.
Oh, they stand up, the children of the Mack.
That was your baby brother.
And I did meet most of your fathers, and I loved them because they all were named Mack, and they all sounded so Southern, and they kept talking to Sissy. And Sissy kept looking as though, what should I do? But actually, the big thing is, Rachel was sincere, she was hardworking, and she wasn't a grand type. She just didn't sit there. She actually did and worked endlessly on campaigns and social things. And you should be very, very proud of her, because in a lifetime, there are very few people I know who say they did something and then you discover they didn't. But in Rachel's case, she did.
That was sent in a letter from my mom to Maggie, and I think that it speaks for itself. In the midst of winter, I have found within myself an invincible summer. I discovered within me a wellspring of friendship, beauty, and hope to sustain me through the coldness of winter.
Ray John.
I went backwards.
I'm going to get a drop. One of the things when we were talking,
see, this actually, this service was wonderful to plan because Mom had already planned it in a way. She had made her expressed her wishes in a little book, in a little booklet, and even had named names. So when it came time to start planning, I just Xeroxed this page and handed it. Give everybody their marching orders. And we were having sort of a meeting, and it was Ralph and people on the list who are named in the order of service, who still are here. And it began to, a picture started to form of Rachel's life as a tapestry, as a weaving of all these different interests that she had. And even literally, a fiber. She was a fiber artist. She made this owl, this macrame owl that's on the wall. And I love that owl because one of the owl is an attribute of the goddess Athena, who's the Greek goddess of craft and weaving. And Mechi. Yeah.
I just wanted to add that, you know, that giant thing that she made, that giant macrame thing, maybe it was hanging in your stairwell. Uh-huh. It's now hanging at People's Church where I am. It's hanging in a stairwell at People's Church. And we're going to put up a little plaque that says,
Oh, that's cool. It lives.
Yes.
Life is short.
I have a picture
long.
Of it on my cell phone.
Okay.
Do you want me to come up?
Her mother, our grandmother, yeah, if you want. Her mother, our grandmother Siegfried, was also had Roman business.
McCutcheon.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at all these McCutcheons. Grandma McCutcheon, Rachel's mom, did alterations and tailoring in Tulsa and, you know, helped support herself and the family that way, and probably taught Mom to sew, and she was always crocheting things and making blankets and bedspreads. And a little one story that I loved was one of her brothers, one of the twins, I don't know if it was Cloyce or Royce, but they were in the war, and he brought home a Japanese silk parachute as a kind of a souvenir. And grandmother McCutcheon cut it up and turned it into a wedding dress for mother. And she married Bob. And then later, I wore it when I got married. And then my daughter Annie also wore it at her wedding. And I used to sew. I worked in bridal, in fact, at Manchester's for years. And I've done a lot of sewing and fiber stuff, and my daughter is also does fashion design now. So there's this very strong thread running through our family. Woven into our family of craft and craftsmanship and just the everyday usefulness, you know, of things that are beautiful. And Mechi, her dear friend, and also a wonderful artist. I'll let you speak about what you did with your mom.
After the real estate thing didn't work out too well for her, she was looking for something else to do to earn money, and she thought of taking up having a sewing job, a sewing position. And the name she took was Wonder Woman. Jeffa was tremendously clever.
Yeah.
And she
passed it around.
Yeah. She commissioned a business card from our service auction, which I did for her. And it's a shield and the needles for a sword. Yeah. And I thought it was pretty fun that she had done that. Anyway, then she had this terrible illness that took so much of the muscle away. And I thought maybe weaving would help her to get it back somewhat. And so one of our members, Lee Bullen, who printed our newsletter,
for years and years, he changed the loom that I had so that it would work with her hands. And she could then get the exercise of feeding and using the shuttle and so forth. And she really enjoyed it quite a lot. I wish we could have kept it up. I couldn't keep up the warping. I just didn't have the time to keep the warping. But she made quite a lot of nice things, and she enjoyed it quite a lot. And that's another thread of her interest.
Thank you.
Yeah, we each of us children have a beautiful scarf that she made us in different colors. And I was ill once with bronchitis for weeks and weeks. And I was cold, and I crocheted myself a little hat with blue and purple yarn. And then not long after that, I got received a package in the mail, and it was this beautiful scarf that Mother had woven in the identical colors. I didn't tell her I was making it. She just, like, knew somehow. I don't know. It was amazing. We have all these nice placemats and things she made. And every day I look at these things, and it just reminds me of her. And she's enriched all of our lives so much.
Here's another mic. I'm terrible with mics. I always seem to do the wrong thing. Like me. I don't think I can hold it because I might have to turn it.
Oh, okay. So
is it on?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to? I can move the stand right there.
It's perfect.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Rachel was one of the original play readers, a group formed more than 35 years ago. People read plays for different reasons, but mostly I think to take them out of their everyday lives and partly perhaps to allow them to explore larger in life concepts without embarrassment, because it's all pretend, you know. Rachel, I believe, enjoyed reading them because they let her escape her conventional self to be deliciously naughty, funny, witty, outrageous. She especially liked quirky characters. And she was very good at interpreting them. Very good. Very tongue-in-cheek, slyly ironic, even daring. Being in the character gave her leave to explore parts of herself that the more serious business of being a professor's wife and mother of four didn't always offer. I recall Rachel's delight the night that she introduced the play from which Pat Watkins and I, also founding play readers, will shortly read to you, Jane Wagner's The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. Play readers met at Siegfried's that night. We were an unusually large group, too. We had 16, 17, 18. I know some of us sat on the floor, feet, back when I could. After reading it, we all agreed that it had been a remarkable experience, and we complimented Rachel lavishly on having chosen it. A Search for Signs of Intelligent Life is a very different play. It's a tour de force presentation by the highly versatile, amazingly gifted actress whom the Wisconsin State Journal, and I have the clipping to prove it, once called that great philosopher, Lily Tomlin. They were absolutely right, and so was Rachel in selecting this play for us. It's crammed with wise and caustic, tender commentaries on the foibles and behaviors of humankind. Rachel related and wanted us also to have the chance to relate to these observations of Trudy, the bag lady. Okay, new persona. I decided we maybe should take in a play. I got goosebumps once that way. So we headed back toward Schubert Alley. On the way to the play, we stopped to look at the stars. And as usual, I felt in awe. And then I felt even deeper in awe
at this capacity we have to be in awe about something. And then I became even more awestruck at the thought that I was, in some small way, a part of that which I was in awe about. And this feeling went on, and on, and on. Suddenly I burst into song. Oh, sweet mystery of life, at last I've found thee. And I felt so good inside, and my heart felt so full. I decided I would set time aside each day to do aerobics. Because at the moment that you are most in awe of all there is about life that you don't understand, you are closer to understanding it at all than at any other time.
Let me read you some of our latest findings. As soon as humankind began to discover the truth about itself, we began to find ways to cover up the truth. But maybe that's for the best. Our ability to delude ourselves may be an important survival tool. We speculated what it was like before we got language skills. When we humans had our first thought, most likely we didn't know what to think. It's hard to think without words because you haven't got a clue as to what you're thinking. So if you think we suffer from a lack of communication now, think what it must have been like then when people lived in a verbal void, made worse by the fact that they had no words such as verbal void. I personally think we developed language because of our deep inner need to complain. Right after we started talking to each other, we began to talk behind each other's backs. Sometimes it was vicious gossip. Other times a casual, critical remark like, geez, did you see the hair on his back? But it dawned on everybody that not only could they talk, but they could also be talked about. Then primitive man began showing signs of paranoia. With everyone so paranoid, war soon broke out. With war comes stress. And the rest is history.
I'm so glad that you came tonight. I sometimes worry no one will show up. And without you, there'd be little point in me being here, wouldn't there? I think you should know I worry a lot. I worry that humanity has been advanced to its present level of incompetency because evolution works on the Peter principle. One thing I have no worry about is whether God exists. But it has occurred to me that God has Alzheimer's and has forgotten that we exist.
Did I tell you what happened at the play? We were at the back of the theater.
You just... I have two more. Frankly, infinity doesn't affect me personally one way or the other. You think too long about infinity, you could go stark raving mad. But I don't ever want to sound negative about going crazy. I don't want to over-romanticize it either. But frankly, going crazy was the best thing that ever happened to me. I don't say it's for everybody. Some people couldn't cope. But for me, it came at a time when nothing else seemed to be working. I got the kind of madness Socrates talked about. A divine release of the soul from the yoke of custom and convention. I refuse to be intimidated by reality anymore. After all, what is reality anyway? Nothing but a collective hunch. My chums think reality was once a primitive method of crowd control that got out of hand. In my view, it's absurdity dressed up in a three-piece business suit. I made some studies, and reality is the leading cause of stress among those in touch with it. I can take it in small doses, but as a lifestyle, I found it too confining. It was just too needful. It expected me to be there for it all the time. Now, since I put reality on a back burner, my days are jam-packed and fun-filled. Like, some days I go hang out around 7th Avenue. I'd love to do this old joke. I wait for some music-loving tourist from one of the hotels on Central Park to go up and ask someone, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Then I run up and yell, practice! The expression on people's faces is priceless. I never could have done stuff like that when I was in my right mind. I'd be worried people would think I was crazy. When I think of the fun I missed, I try not to be bitter.
Did I tell you what happened at the play? We were at the back of the theater, standing there in the dark, and all of a sudden I feel someone tug my sleeve and whisper, Trudy, look. And I said, yeah, goosebumps. You definitely have goosebumps. You really like the play that much? They said it wasn't the play that gave them the goosebumps. It was the audience. I forgot to tell them to watch the play, and they've been watching the audience. Yeah, to a group, see a group of strangers sitting together in the dark, laughing and crying about the same things, that just knocked people out. They said, Rudy, the play was soup. The audience was art. So they're taking their goosebumps home with them. Quite a souvenir. I like to think of them out there in the dark watching us. Sometimes we'll do something and they'll laugh. Sometimes we'll do something and they'll cry. And maybe one day we'll do something so magnificent that everybody in the universe will get goosebumps. I just want to say we had so much fun at Play Readers with Rachel. And that's the role I guess I remember her mostly in, and how we loved to come to her house and settle down in front of the fireplace on her settee there, and she always served the best refreshments during the intermission. And we're going to miss that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Another foot or
something. How's that? Very good. This is in the tapestry. Perhaps the lighter threads show out better when there's some dark in those threads too. And I think Ralph spoke to that a little. This is a poem Mom wanted at her service, and I thought it was really beautiful. I'd never heard of it until I read it after I saw it in her instructions. So the name of the play is Dover Beach. It's by Matthew Arnold, who was a Victorian poet. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand, begin and cease, and then begin again. With tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy, long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That last is a reference to Thucydides, who was an ancient Greek historian who wrote about a very bad, bad time of the hopeless war that no one could win.
We now like to invite the sharing of a special memory or tribute. If you would like to come forward and use the microphone, we would invite you to do so briefly. Come forward.
It sometimes pays not to clean out my music bag. I didn't know, I forgot I had this. If someone wants to know an address, I'll make copies afterwards. You're welcome to pass it around. I'd like it back afterwards.
The cosmic bag.
Put one of your addresses and a pencil on the back, and I'll see to you.
Oh, that's great.
Back, if everybody wants to put an address down, I'll send you all copies. I was there when that was taken. I remember people here who were there. They made the great big Valentine that went to President Reagan, I believe. I can't remember the issue. Does anybody remember? The other picture that's being passed around that has this accordion player on it, who's changed a little bit since the picture was taken. Rachel was a strong supporter of Ada Deer, and Ada had gone off to Washington, D.C. for an event, and she came back to the airport, and Rachel dressed up in her Wonder Woman costume. I got out my accordion, and we welcomed her back out here to visit the Dane County Airport. Did not get arrested, so wonderful memory should come on.
You're lucky
it was then, not now. Yeah. Yeah. I meant to mention when I was working with Rachel with the loom that she always made a wonderful lunch for us, and she took great pride in making even a whole chicken dinner. And I also appreciate the fact that she was so gracious. Even though she had come from such a poverty-stricken situation in the years of the Dust Bowl and everything, she had such a graciousness about her. And I picked up on something. She was calling her ex-husband her former husband. I thought, gee, that sounds a lot nicer. That's what I
Former. Yes.
Yes, I'm here representing the Friends of the Younger Degeneration. And I recall meeting Rachel. I was living out on a farm out east of here, and John was over there. He probably biked out from Madison. He said, "My mom wants to meet you." I said, "Okay." And she comes out, and instead of lumbering out of the car with judgment, she just jumped out of the car and just eager to see what was going on, meet John's friends, and just be a part of the whole scene. And for 20, 30 years after that, Rachel had the ability to make a bench at a kitchen table feel comfortable because she was so welcoming. And she really taught us all about that. And I miss her.
Showed up in Prairie, Rachel was one of the only people I knew because she and Nechi and I had sung together, had all been altos in the choir at First Society. And music, I would say music, flowers, and Prairie were the three things that we carried carried together. The first committee that I was chair of, I was co-chair of with Rachel, the Denominational Affairs Committee, way back in the 70s. And she gave us wildflowers from her garden as a wedding present when we lived out in the country. And after she was sick, I was singing with the MATC, a course at MATC and moving out in the country. So I would come, when she got home, I would come there once a week and we'd have, I'd bring soup and she'd make sandwiches or whatever and we'd have a little supper before I went off to my rehearsal. And then after she was feeling better, she said, you know, I'd like to get back to singing the symphony chorus, but I'd like you to join and drive. So that's what we did, and so the only reason I'm in the symphony chorus today is because of Rachel.
Linda Dale, won't you please say something?
Oh, it's Linda. Okay.
It's a
brush.
Yeah.
Okay. I was, when we lived in Berkeley, I used to go to Malvina Reynolds' house because she invited people who liked to sing. And she introduced little boxes at that time. Now, I remember one time we were singing Little Boxes here at Prairie. And Rachel was very upset because she felt that we were making fun of these small, affordable houses, that she was very grateful to have an opportunity to live in. So I've never felt the same about Little Boxes.
I want to say something about Rachel and food. Rose and I and our daughter, Nevena, lived in Madison in the late 70s, 76 to 79, when we became involved with Prairie, including Rachel. And that was the era when the cookbook, the Prairie cookbook, was put together.
Oh, yeah.
It was called the Prairie Kitchen Companion. There's a copy of it in here, and if you look in that book, I don't know how many recipes there are that go on and on and on with the name Siegfried. Many of them Rachel's, some of them Maggie's.
John's insane brownies.
Really good recipes. And I actually made one of those, I think it was yours.
Oh, the rhubarb?
The rhubarb crisp, sort of. Not a crisp, but what do you call it? Anyway, it's in here, you can try it. But she was a very, very good cook and very fond of food, and she was very much part of that wonderful production that the Bullens printed on their own little home hand printing press. So it's very much part of the prayer.
Rachel was the editor of the written word. I was the editor of the art, which she was co-editor of.
Well, Rose and I contributed. Our daughter did a number of the drawings in it. We were all very involved.
It's wonderful. I was looking at it today.
Well, I was very honored to be able to share Rachel's home for a few years. She always had two housemates, and it was really always peaceful and wonderful there. I met her here at Prairie when I came in about 1984, and lived there until 1988. When my daughter graduated at the university, and She went to California, I went to Milwaukee, so I could work since then. And one of the things that Rachel loved especially was to travel, and she adored her family. She was totally, that was number one for her. So we went out to the West Coast twice because my daughter was out there in Long Beach, and her, lots of her family were out on the West Coast, and we both enjoyed traveling. One of the times was really memorable. We went to the San Juan Islands where they didn't allow cars, but they did have mopeds. And I'd never been on a moped. And in order to rent one, we got us to the top of what looked like a mountain to me, and we were supposed to ride down. So they said, this is how it works. And Rachel, this is her idea. So we both got on our mopeds, made it safely to the bottom of the hill, and had a wonderful time in the San Juan Islands on our mopeds. So we did a lot of wonderful things out west and traveling, and it was so fantastic. I really miss it. It was wonderful.
Thank you. And a little thing about the ever fun-loving Rachel, and about a time when I was getting ready to lie about my age, my 65th birthday, Rachel showed up with a whole bag full of gold carnival or New Year's Eve type hats, and she made everybody put them on. This was a party at Pat Cartley's, another very dear friend who passed away a couple of years ago. And this was about the time when Rachel and I found that we danced well together. You know, they had dances at the Memorial Union, Great Hall. And they always played a mix of music, folksy and swing and stuff. And we just had a ball dancing together. So this is one of the fun memories, really. And when she was in this memory care hospital just recently before the end, that was one thing she remembered. Mm-hmm. We talked about it when I visited. Mm-hmm. She did remember those things.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kill one of these things, yeah.
No one's mentioned Rachel Ann Raspberries. Those of you who knew her well remember that she had a terrific raspberry patch out back at the house on Tillman Terrace. And she was very generous with her raspberries. I think earlier on she used them for cooking and so forth, but when her hands got worse and she wasn't so well, she would tell different people, why don't four of you come out this week? The raspberries are going to be ready. And she'd say, if you help me pick them, you can pick them, I'll take some and you can have the rest, you know. And say, dress carefully now, there are bees and stinging insects out there. And so you go out there in a shirt down to your wrists and gloves on a hot summer day, and you know, your pants tied, and she even thought you should wear a hat with netting, which was real cute, and you know, a swelter. But it did help. And I was thinking of how generous she was. She had quite a green thumb. And there were always green things growing around her house, and she loved spending time putting them in. And so sort of for the sake of the raspberries and for the sharing, I brought a lot of raspberries today. It's not exactly raspberry season, but I found some. And so I hope we can all share them and think about Rachel and how she shared hers.
Thank you.
Mom had asked to have a flower communion for her memorial service, so we accumulated a lot of flowers out in the lobby, and we're going to bring some of them in. And she wants everybody to take a flower home, at least one. But then there was a logistical issue of potluck, so if you want to take a flower and set it aside. We have extra vases and to keep your flower fresh until you have your potluck dinner. So we'll bring some in.
The flower communion is actually a Unitarian Universalist ritual that was founded by Reverend Norbert Chopek, the minister of the largest Unitarian congregation in Europe and at that time in the world. Reverend Chopek was a minister in Prague, Czechoslovakia, before World War II. And in the flower communion, people in that region loved flowers, so they would bring a flower and it would be put into a receptacle, a vase, a basket, and then you would come forward and take a flower. So if you would like to come forward, pick a flower and take it, look at it. It's meant to symbolize the beauty of every individual, the beauty of nature, the way in which nature sings with so many melodies. And in doing so, we hope that we are honoring and remembering Rachel, because she was a gardener and she loved flowers. So, quietly, if you would like, come forward, take a blossom, a bloom, and then return, and then I will close with a reading, and then we'll have our choir. We're not closed yet. No, I will close the flower communion portion, and then we have the choir, and then some closing words. Beauty of the flower. Let us enter the silence.